I've enjoyed playing here. This has been over 20 years that I've been coming to Royal Melbourne. And this is where golf should be played.
We love coming down under.
Look, it's phenomenal to play. The quality of the golf's been great. But the enthusiasm of the people has been the thing that's just been amazing.
Tier of courses that I'm willing to shave my neck for in Kingston Heath to Victoria. Get me out of bed to shave.
Especially somewhere like Australia in the Sand Belt, and I have so many great memories of being down there.
G'day and welcome back to Australian Golf Passport. I'm Matt Molica, sitting in with introductions for Scott Warren, who's on a well-deserved family break, laying down in the sun. Really, really special episode for you today to round out 2023. We have Mike Clayton coming back to discuss all things golf with us and also give us a little bit of a look inside the mind of Mike. We talk about a broad range of topics, not just golf, but a couple of different things that make him tick. Really, really wonderful and entertaining to speak with Mike as always. Scott did brilliantly in skippering this episode. A couple of tech issues from my end which plagued us and compromised audio quality a little bit, but it's still an excellent listen that we hope you enjoy. Let's get straight into it. An hour and a half with Mike Clayton.
I grew up this, and I think a lot of us do, this massive chip on our shoulder about being Australian and living in Australia, and you think Britain and Europe and America must be heaps better. And then I moved to London in my 20s. And it was great and I enjoyed it. But then ultimately you're like, I just want to go home and I want to live in Australia and I want to raise a family in Australia and I want to be Australian. You're kind of going to go and eyeball the rest of the world to realize how good we've got it.
But there are, you know, there are obviously amazing things about being in London. You just go to France for the weekend or Sweden or Spain, or, you know, you can go to so many different places. But mind you, we can go to, I guess going to Perth is not the same as going to Paris for the weekend or the south of France. Maybe it is. Maybe we just kind of, we take what we have for granted, probably everywhere. Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
And you never see things through the eyes of a tourist when you're in Australia. Yeah, we drove up to Healesville yesterday and everyone's going, this is an amazing country. It's so beautiful. It's like, we just look at it like, yeah. But
whatever.
Yeah, no matter where you go, if you look at things through the eyes of a tourist, it's always more impressive.
Yeah.
Whenever I come back from an overseas trip, I walk around the city and I start to look up and think, I never do this normally. Yeah. I did this all the time I was away. Why don't I do this while I'm here?
Yeah, and that's true. Yeah.
I was going to say, Sydney side's the most guilty of that, because when's the last time we went on the ferry over to Manly, or when's the last time we went to the Powerhouse Museum, or when you had a beer at Opera Bar? And you don't do it, do you? And then you lament what you don't have when actually it's 40 minutes away. You just never do it.
We had friends who flew in from London. Well, they were here. They stayed with us in Melbourne, then went to Queensland. And then we had an Airbnb in Manly. And I said, look, we can pick you up at the airport, but it's way easier to get a train to the ferry terminal and get the ferry. And they kind of got off the ferry in Manly. They couldn't believe it. Like, this place is unbelievable. Like, go to the Western Suburbs, it's pretty shit. Or go and play golf at the Australian, it's pretty shit. But I shouldn't say that, but the amazing parts of Sydney are incredible.
Yeah.
How is Healesville looking?
The greens are mushy and soft.
Okay.
So I wouldn't say it was in great shape, but it's really good. I mean, Lloyd, it was perfect choice for Lloyd because you don't hit the ball very far and it's just playable and fun. And it's the perfect course for 70% of people who play golf?
Yeah.
Yeah,
you know, the women can all play off the back tees, and that's still shorter than the average women's course. You know, I played with a 74-year-old guy there in a pro-am a year ago or something. He would never break 85 at Metro or the Australian or the Lakes or Royal Queensland. So I love this course. Every time I come here, I think I can break my age.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a serious. It treats you seriously as a golfer. Not just basic public course junk. It's actually, the mowing lines are good, the greens are good, the holes are good. You've got to hit interesting decisions, make interesting decisions and hit good shots. And it's a short version of golf. It's perfect.
Yeah.
And you can hit greens.
Yeah.
The average guy can hit. You know, the average guy who might hit two greens at Metro can hit eight greens there.
Can't remember which of the Northern Sydney courses it was. I think it might have been Pimble. In the rankings edition of Golf Australia magazine, which is out now, biannual rankings edition.
Yeah, I saw that. I just saw that, yeah.
Comments, and I think it was about Pimble that I said, like Northern Sydney's full of courses that are screaming out for a golf course like Healesville, but they're obsessed with 6,000 meters and par 70 plus.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
You could build six of Healesville in Northern Sydney, and I reckon people would rave about it. But
yeah. No, that's right. They would love it. And if you got it in great shape and you had, you know, if you know, they showed it, you know, the love that Metro gets, or, you know, it was in great condition, then it would be an amazing golf course to play.
I mean, it was mushy 10 years ago when I played it. I've heard that reasonably regularly since. You've just described it yesterday. Is that on purpose, or is that because they don't spend the money on it that they should to maintain it?
I don't know. I'm not there often enough to know, really. I don't really know.
They've had 85 mil of rain in the last 7 weeks.
Yeah, it's been wet. It's been wet. And the green
is well, that's pretty fair, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's an interesting course to set up. There's no excuse for one dull pin there ever. You know, people look at pins as easy and hard, and they kind of shy away from hard pins. But having said that, the pins were pretty good yesterday. There were some good ones. Yeah.
I remember that's one thing you would often say to me at Bonnie Doon when you were working there, and you're saying, oh, we've built this really great pin position, or we've built this great, if you put the tee forward and the pin here, it's a great hole.
Like on 13, yeah.
But they'll never do that.
No, they never do it. You know, they never put the pin, the tee far left on 13 and the pin back right, which was the whole idea of that right pin, was if you put the tee way to the left, then you could play across that green and get to that pin.
Yeah.
But you know, people who set the course up rarely, if ever, think of that. St Andrews Beach is the most frustrating, when the pin is almost literally never in the back of the seventh green or the front of the ninth green, or, you know, that's just, well, they're the two most obvious examples. You know, it's never back right at 12. Mm. Or they just put it's just mindlessly just stick the pin on the green somewhere.
Yeah. We talked about that back pin at seven last time. Well, not last time, because last time was the Moore Park episode. The first time you're on this podcast, we talked about that back pin on seven being like the great barometer of if someone's a good player. You'd plonk them in the fairway with 160 to that back pin downwind and say, hit a shot.
Yeah. We played the game there. It was a forerunner of the Sandbelt tournament. We had a 36 holes. Jeff and I put this thing together with in COVID, where we just had, I don't know, 50 kids play. It's like Sue played and Brendan Goddard played and different people and mostly pros. And he hit a shot. It was into the wind. The hole was into the wind and the pin was at the back. And hit this 5-iron that kind of pitched into the face of the slope and jumped up to about 10 feet. And it was a shot only a US Open champion could hit, really. You know, I mean, obviously not. You know, people could, you know, if you had one shot at it, most people would take 10 or 15 or 20 balls, if ever, to hit that shot. And he hit it with one shot. It was like, that's why he won the US Open.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he had a shot recently. He was back at Winged Foot. And I saw on his Instagram, Ogilvy recreated his little pitch into the 72nd hole.
Yeah.
And I think it showed off the difficulty of that shot way better than the US Open telecast, because it shots from up high on the telecast and it makes it look like a flat shot.
Yeah.
I think his missus shot it on an iPhone from behind him and you were like, holy shit, that is such a hard shot.
Yeah.
And it was on the last hole of a major when he's in the lead. Like, it really does show you, like, the rest of us don't have that shot. That goes a foot if I'm trying to hit it.
Yeah. No, your back foot, stab it. You put it on your back foot and you jam it low and you hope it spins and you just... Because that was a shot he learned to play over there, really, where you use, you know, use the bounce and get the ball up in your stance and don't take a divot. And perfect shot, really. Yeah. Well, that was that stupid tournament where everyone thought Mickelson blew it and Monty blew it. And that, you know, Jeff was the only one who could, under the pressure, make a sensible decision and hit the shots that were required.
Yep.
Mickelson couldn't think that he's way out of a paper bag on the hole. And Monty, you know, fat chunked the 7-iron, which was the shot he'd, you know, made millions of dollars on. I mean, that was his career shot, was a my favorite, the 7-iron. I mean, you couldn't have given him a better shot to hit. And neither of them could do it. So not sure why they deserve to win. You know.
I often think about Monty and wonder how much time he spends ruminating on that shot. Because that, as you said, that was his bread and butter. He won six orders of merit on the Euro Tour just hitting that shot.
I mean, it was just an automatic 15-foot shot for Monty his whole career. You know, he made six out of it. It's like, what are you doing, Monty?
Mm.
And they're not easy to win those things, which is why, you know, that's why messes like that happen. You know, people just, they either can't hit the shot or they can't think.
Why, they're the only four tournaments that matter now.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they are. Yeah. God, is it, how bad is pro golf now? Is it just descended into, I don't, I mean, people just tell you now, like, oh, they're not interested and they don't watch anymore.
Yeah, I'm one of them. Yeah. But, mate, you mentioned that shot Ogilvy hit at St Andrews Beach in what became the Sandbelt Invitational as kind of the proof of concept. And that's just been run and won for another year. And it looks like yet another, I think that's the third one and three great successes.
The third one, yeah. I mean, there were a few things that amazed me. One was that it's tough to get our LPGA players. So shout out to Robin Choi, who was the only one who had a legitimate I'm tired excuse. And she played the LPGA Tour School, won that, got on a plane, arrived here on Sunday, registered and played the tournament. So she gets 100 points for me from that. Good for her. It's hard to get people to watch because it's Monday to Thursday and it's kind of, you know, it's just hard to get people to watch. But I know that if the equivalent of Cameron Davis and Nicholas Coulthard and Jeff Ogilvy were playing in Melbourne when I was a kid, there'd have been 300 of us out watching him play because you didn't see golf on TV. So you just, if you wanted to watch a pro play golf, you had to watch a pro play golf.
Yeah, so I mean, notwithstanding it's a pretty low-key event, it's a good chance for good golfers to get one last set of competitive reps before they hang the clubs up for Christmas.
Yeah, and it's fun. You know, Justin does a great job, works for Jess Foundation, does a great job of the little details he does. You know, the tee markers are really cool, the food's great, the clubs are fantastic, and it's not too onerous on the clubs. It's just one day. It's not like a regular tournament where the members get put out for a week or more because the circus moves into town. But, you know, it's half a day and there are no grandstands and no TV and, you know, it's just not too big a deal. And they like it. You know, the clubs are great. They enjoy it and treat us well and the kids like it. So it's, you know, it's a good event all round. So hopefully we can keep it going.
Yeah, fingers crossed. I think it certainly adds something to the summer of golf and it's a bit different to everything else. You know, and for a spectator, you can stand 10 feet from someone like Cameron Davis and watch him hit the shots that, what's he, number 42 or 43 in the world? Yeah, those guys hit different shots, don't they?
Yeah. Yeah, he's probably good. That's fun to watch. And it's fun to watch golf from behind. You know, so much pro golf now you're watching from the sides, and it's just better to stand behind someone from behind and watch how the ball comes out. And you can kind of tell whether they're hitting it, whether they're aiming or not.
Yeah.
So it's a cool way to watch golf. And it was a miracle. The weather's been so bad in Melbourne. It's just been windy and rainy, and you know, we had lightning at Yarra Yarra. The first day we started 3 hours late because Victoria got, there was, I think, 7 or 8 bunkers. You couldn't play that day. It was smashed by the crazy amount of rain we had early on Monday morning. So it was. And it's a weird tournament because we went to see Lloyd Cole on Wednesday night with Chris Kane, and his girlfriend said, "I just come from work." I'm like, "What are you coming from work for on Saturday?" Because it was the third round, and you just assume, "Why are you working on Saturday?" I was like, "Ah, so it's Wednesday." So we forget. So it's weird. Just the dynamics of a golf tournament. You just assume the third day is Saturday, and you know, it's weird when you start on Monday. And anyway, it's and it works well with Cathedral. You know, a lot of them get to play those two events at the end of the year when there's guaranteed money and no cart, and so not much stress, but good golf and good courses.
And we know that pro golfers these days, they love two things. It's guaranteed money and no cart. And if you're given some free OWGR points, all the better.
You've got them all, yeah. Yeah, maybe we should try and get some Tigers points. I mean, how was that? Australia? I mean, what was last place in the Tigers event was the same as winning the Australian Open or 12th in the Australian Open?
I think fifth, maybe, I want to say.
Whatever it was. It was
high up, yeah.
Yeah. But the OWGR is just a joke now. They should just get rid of them. Because they don't need them anyway. The majors can figure out how to put together the 50 best players in the world. And You know, take the top five off 11, whatever, in the top. You know, it wouldn't be hard to put together a legitimate list of 50 players who everyone would agree they should be in.
Yeah.
Which is what the OWGR does now, right? It's pretty much all.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, it's going to keep popping up. I saw on Twitter tonight that, you know, Dustin Johnson's now the 164th best player in the world in the OWGR. I mean, we all know he's not that.
Yeah.
And so I don't think it's I don't think it's mutually exclusive to view it that LIV shouldn't be getting OWGR points because of the system, but that the OWGR as a result is you know, not irrelevant, but it's got some significant major issues.
Yeah. Well, it's so American-centric now. You know, the Europeans are the ones who get completely raped by not having enough points. And, you know, there are good players everywhere. There are good players wherever you go. There, I was at the European Tour School this year, and there were lots of good players everywhere.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, it's partly the fault of the equipment that everyone does the same thing with their driver now. Everyone just drives the ball like Greg Norman did, but 30, 20 yards further.
Yeah.
So it's so much harder to break out of the pack now because the equipment's so homogenized the talent.
Yeah. Now, we sometimes see people online saying, oh, my God, I'm playing with Mike Clayton and he's using a tailor-made sim or whatever. And then we see, you know, yesterday at Healesville, a video of you hitting persimmons. What, for you now, and you're clearly still a very good player in terms of, you know, the bastion of the pantheon of golf. What interests you about a round of golf now? Is it still competing? Is it just hitting fun shots? Is it just about company? Is it about looking at architecture? What is it that gets you onto the first tee?
Yeah, it's playing with friends. So Lloyd was here, you know, Lloyd Cole's in town. He's done with his tour, so he's he's playing golf. So we're playing with two guys, two great guys. They just put us with these two random guys at Yarra Yarra, who were both. Like one of them was a fantastic player, three handicap, but he was actually better than that. He was really good. And but they're in the comp, like everyone in Australia, they're in the comp. And Lloyd's going, like, why are these guys all, why are they scoring? Why don't they just play golf? So we're obsessed with playing comps, which I just don't play anymore. Not that I ever did, but you know, so club golf is so centered around playing the comp. Where so Lloyd's going, like, why don't people just have a match and play golf? So we miss that in Australia. So I like playing good courses. So we played Healesville the first day, Yarra Yarra today. So you're playing, and Lloyd hadn't seen Yarra Yarra since Stoke had fixed it. So you know, he couldn't believe how much better it was. But you know, there's this comedy in Melbourne about this little cohort of people who think they've ruined Yarra Yarra. Well, that's why it's gone from 50 to 16 in the rankings. You know, if they've ruined it, then that's a pretty nice ruination. But so you know, it was interesting to talk to him about what he, you know, how he saw the course he played 8 years ago to the course he played today. So, and Healesville was great fun because he never played there. And that's a cool course to play and really interesting. And it's a model for what, you know, the majority of people should be playing a course that length. 5,000 meters is a great length for most people. And hitting shots, you know, so you miss the competitive thing, kind of the fun of hitting a good shot in a competition is, I played one tournament round last year. Richard Cooney and I played the Bob Shearer foursomes at Southern. It was the only tournament round I played all year, which was kind of really weird because that had been my life really. Well, you know, I just, you know, I played as much as anyone competitively when I played. So that was, but yeah, the course, the company, the fun, hitting shots, trying, you know, playing with a persimmon wood because, I mean, you would never play with a persimmon wood in a tournament because why would you? Because it doesn't go as far and it's harder to hit, but it's way more fun. You know, it's a McGregor, that old wood's, you know, it's the best. It's a 1960 club. So it's, you know, it's 60 years old at least, but still beautiful to play with. And when you hit it, it's great. It feels, you know. And of course, Lucas took it out of Healesville. And two times he hit it, he hit these massive hooks with it.
Yeah.
You know, so he would be fine. If you practice with it, he'd be fine. But they're not, you know, they were much, they weren't that difficult to hit. They were just, you know, they did a much better job of differentiating between a really good swing and an average swing and a bad swing. And you can just put a very average swing on a modern driver and a ball, you can't tell the difference.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
But so if you're trying your hardest around Metro, what's the range that you're likely to shoot?
Well, I never try my hardest, but, you know, if I shot par, that'd be a good day.
Yeah,
back tees, you know. I don't shoot 5 under very often or ever. And I'm getting short. I mean, it's amazing how short I get it. I mean, like, it just feels like it's, you know, just a, you just sort of notice that I could easily have got there with a 7-iron 2 years ago, but now it's a 6, and, you know, it's kind of weird. But I remember reading about Peter Thompson. He wrote about, you know, I started off hitting the ball 100 yards, and then I hit it 280 yards. Now I'm back to hitting it 100 yards again. It's just the journey of golf, right? So it's,
yeah,
it's interesting to see how that kind of plays out. And if you were serious, you would get in the gym and you would make sure you didn't, you know, you kind of maintain some sort of level of strength and fitness. And we also do that when we get older, really. But
feels like the world is your gym, though. It feels like you are out and about every day. You know, you're playing a lot of golf. You're walking a lot of rounds, carrying a staff bag as a caddy. It feels like you might not be in the gym, but it seems like you're active probably 7 days a week.
Yeah, and I walk a lot, which is good. You know, you should walk. And my grandfather walked a lot. He walked around the block every day for whatever, a few miles, and he walked fast. So walking was always part of, and I just detest playing golf in a golf cart. But I did it this year, and Sue Owen and I played at Fort Worth in the end of June when the weather was just horrifically hot. Of course, there were no members there because they all go to Colorado because it's just cool. So, you know, I thought, I can play in a golf cart, that's fine. But there aren't many excuses for playing in a golf cart. We were at Hillsley that day, and behind us were like these 20-year-old guys in a golf cart. Like, what are you doing? I mean, this is the easiest course in the world to walk around. I mean, why are you in a golf cart?
Yeah.
Anyway, they are because that's what they do, but I don't get it. I will never understand that.
Oddly enough, a lot of the professional sports people aren't allowed, at least in season, to play golf and walk. Part of their contracts is if they play golf, they have to ride in a cart. But then obviously Glenn Maxwell fell off a freaking golf cart at the Cricket World Cup and missed a game with a concussion. So,
Yeah, the only way to fall off a golf cart is if you're doing something stupid, isn't it? I would have thought.
I honestly don't know anyone who's had a golf cart related incident who didn't have a skin full of piss at the time.
Yeah, it's probably a reasonable assumption.
Just a brief interlude here to discuss a special offer from one of our two supporters, Burnley Brewing. They're open New Year's Eve and from noon until late on New Year's Day. For those of you out there looking for a good way to bring in 2024 or to just get rid of the dust and the cobwebs after a big New Year's Eve the night prior, they've currently got a Nitro Coffee Brown Ale on sale. 4 packs for $20 in a 440ml can. This stuff is fantastic. Brewed using a fresh cold brew, the blend is comprised of naturally processed coffees from Ethiopia and Brazil. One's fruit driven and the other is creamy. So go and take a look at Burnley Brewing. As I said, open New Year's Eve and New Year's Day, 648 to 650 Bridge Road in Richmond, just around the corner from the famed Burnley Golf Course. Let's get back into it with Clates.
And so are you someone who's always on are you always on? Are you always moving? Do you ever just, like, do you ever chill? Do you relax? What does that look like for you? If you're going to have a day off and relax,
what's it look like? No, I don't. Have, my wife goes nuts. But no, I don't have days off really much. You know, we're building a little course for a guy 2.5 hours north of Melbourne on his property. So I was up there on a few days ago. I don't remember what it was. You know, Lucas is building that, so that's fun. And then I drove back past Earing Meadows, and because we're working at Earing Meadows now, doing a plan for them.
Mm-hmm.
So I walked around that with the owner, which was, well, the owner's a Chinese owner. With her daughter, who's kind of in charge, 20-year-old kid who's great. She knows nothing about golf. So I'm teaching her, which is great fun. Because she, you know, I turned up and, let's go walk the back nine. So out she goes and, you know, we walk around the back nine and she, you know, I take her here and take her there and look at this and look at that. And it's fun. She, you know, she's interested. That's good. That's great fun.
It's so exciting because I feel like the last client you had who knew nothing about golf was probably Richard Sattler. And that turned out
probably.
Right.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. They're often the... Well, you know, that was the best brief ever. It was, I don't care what you do, just don't screw it up. You know, which is the perfect brief for any sort of contract you have with anyone. I don't care what you do, just don't screw it up.
Yeah.
Because you assume by in hiring something that they know what they're doing. So why tell them how to do their job?
Well, that's a question you could probably ask a lot of golf club boards who hire architects to do renovations and then want to handhold, you know, through that process. But must be nice to have someone who just says, you're the expert, do what you want to do.
Yeah, and it's almost as though the lower down the rankings the course is, the bigger the argument is with the members to change it. It's weird. Like at Victoria, we started at Victoria in 1995. And we took the old black and white photo into the committee meeting. Ian Meckham was the captain. And we said, you should put this back. And there was, you know, someone said, one of the guys, which was, it was a good question. Didn't think it was a good question, but no. He said, what, do we all want to go back and drive 1930 cars? Thought, well, my answer was, well, I wouldn't mind driving a 1930 Rolls Royce because that's what you had. I didn't say that, but that was what they had.
Yeah.
Victoria is a fantastic golf course, and it was never remotely close to being a bad golf course. It was always a very good golf course. But they turned it from a 1930 Rolls Royce into a Holden Monaro by 1975. And in 1975, no one was talking about golf course architecture in Australia. Kingston Heath was not Kingston Heath in 1975. It wasn't the 22nd. The 1975 version of Kingston Heath, there's not a chance it'd be a top 100 course in Australia right now.
Wow.
Not in the world.
In the world. Okay.
Yeah. And it'd be, if you put 1975 Kingston Heath in Australia now, it'd be maybe 20, maybe. Soft, mushy poet greens, trees everywhere. You know, before the restoration of 11 and 12 and 15 and, you know, regrassing the greens and nulling the condition and all the things they did to make that golf course what it is. I mean, it was a long way away 40 years ago. But in Victoria, going back to the question about do we all want to go back and drive 1930 cars, you know, that was the extent of, you know, about 15 minutes later, a guy called Tony Joyce said, well, let's give them the fourth and the seventh holes because they surely can't screw them up, because it was just about putting the bunkers back. And I knew Bruce Grant could build bunkers. And we just went and put the bunkers back, and that turned out well, and it just kind of evolved from there. But there was never, you know, an argument about, I think the fourth hole's a great hole, and why are you changing that? Or, but, you know, we're working at a place now where there's a hole there that there are members who think it's a good hole, and it's just atrocious. It's like, how can we be having this discussion about this hole when it's so clearly a terrible hole? But, you know, there's always someone that loves their own mud heap, as Mackenzie said.
Correct.
So, you know, how do you deal with that? Well, and it's, you know, you have to deal with it, and it's interesting, and you just, you know, you often, you know, if you can put forward a persuasive and sensible enough argument, then you win. So, you know, and it shouldn't be about winning or losing. It should be about putting a, you know, and taking someone to the 11th at Kingston Heath and saying, well, this is a great sliding left to right doggy. This is how you do it. What are the principles that make this such a great hole? And what are the principles that your hole's not obeying that make it, in my eyes, such a bad hole? And it's like really obvious. But you've got to go and stand on the 12th tee, on the 11th tee at Kingston Heath to see what's wrong with this other hole.
Yeah.
And so many people, you know, you can live in Melbourne and you talk about the 11th at Kingston Heath or the 6th at Royal Melbourne, and you just assume they know the hole because, well, it's the 11th at Kingston Heath. Of course you know the hole, but some of them have maybe never played it or played it once or twice, and they don't remember it, or, you know, I make the assumption that people know all these holes, and often if they do know them, they don't know them very well, and if they don't know them very well, they certainly haven't thought about them or thought about why they're great, or they're just worried about hitting the ball down the fairway and getting on the green and making a four or a five and going on. They're not sort of studying that hole and thinking, why is this the best flat sliding left to right dog leg in Australia?
Yeah. And I think that's like, you sometimes have arguments with people about golf holes or golf courses, and they'll say, oh, well, you know, it's all subjective and there's no right or wrong. But I feel like golf architecture is maybe that discipline of art where, yes, there is art, but there's also an underlying like mathematics or formula or science, whatever you want to call it. There are some things that don't work or are wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. There are bad golf holes. You know, Bill Corr would call them stinkers. And, you know, the best holes in the world don't all follow the same principles. But, you know, Peter Thompson told me once, he said, holes over trees are always second-class holes. And, you know, the one tree at Royal Melbourne that just annoys the hell out of me is that tree on the, that stupid tree on the bottom of the hill on the third on the east course. It's just why is that tree there? You know, it got planted 50 years after, 40 years after Alec Russell built the golf course. But, you know, you look at the 11th hole of Victoria now compared to what it was 25 years ago. It's just completely transformed just by following the principle of holes over trees are always second-class holes. We'll cut the trees down. It took 20 years to cut the trees down, but as soon as the trees, you know, and Victoria got back into the top 100 this year in the world. And you could make an argument it was because of that hole. That hole broke the back. It was a bad hole it was formerly a fantastic hole, but that turned into a bad hole that we eventually got back to the state it was in 1933, and it's back to being a great hole again. Yeah. And it's a hole like that that can make or break whether you finish 96 in the World Top 100 or 105. It can be one hole like that.
Mm.
And a rated season goes, wow, that's a great hole.
You know, it has necessarily no right to be a highlight of the course, because often those long uphill par fours are a connector in the routing that gets you from a desirable place to play to another desirable place, like 11 at Pasatiempo does.
Yeah.
But 11 at Victoria is, for me, it's probably one of the four best holes on the course. It shouldn't be, given what it is.
No, well, it's uphill, but it's not uphill that much. It's a cool second shot. But it's a fantastic hole, I think, you know. Would I pick it as the best hole in the course? Maybe. I mean, 9's great, although not as interesting as 14 at Kingston Heath, because the cross bunkers, those left bunkers at Kingston Heath have more of an influence on the second shot than the trees at the left of the 9th of Victoria do. 15's arguably you guys spoke about short par fours a few weeks ago. It's not the most spectacular short par four in the country. Probably 4 at Bumboogalies or 14 at Lost Farm or maybe 14 at New South Wales, but it's the most vexing hole. What do I do here? What's the right shot? And I still sound that tee and what do I do here today? Well, you play a hole like the 16th at Metro and I've played that hole for 50 years and it's just driver. Hit down the fairway, hit over the bunkers, and I've never thought about that tee shot once ever.
Yeah.
Which is kind of weird, you know.
But to show that, you know, everyone's got a fan somewhere, like when we did our short fours episode, some of the feedback, I recall we had a couple of DMs saying, I can't believe you missed the 16th at Metro.
Yeah, which was just like,
Yeah, I mean, I could do a list of the top 100 short fours in Australia and I wouldn't list the 16th at Metro.
No, it's way behind the third at Kerlewis or any one of three or four short par fours at Healesville. It's just not a very good hole. You know, it's a beautiful green, but it makes no sense because the further you go from the bunkers and the further away from the corner of the dogleg you play, the better the line in theory into the flag.
Yeah.
So what's the point of the bunkers? So what's the point of the hole? You know, the members love it. You know, we tried to get it changed when we worked there, but you know, but if you ask them to write a 500-word essay on the strategic merits of the 15th hole, the 16th at Metro versus the 15th at Victoria, they'd get a fail probably.
Yeah.
What are the strategic merits of the hole? You either hit it over the fairway, down the fairway, or you hit it over the bunker, or you do what Lucas does, and you hit it blind over the trees to a target you can't see. Well, that doesn't work ever. That's why the 10th at Royal Melbourne's such a great hole, or the 4th at Bumboogal, because you're hitting it over a hazard on the ground, not a hazard in the air.
Yeah. I recall, I think I asked him when someone raised that hole with us, and I thought, well, I have strong feelings. Am I wrong? I texted Lucas and said, how do you play 16 at Metro? And, you know, I think his answer essentially was, I blasted over the trees into a greenside bunker and try and get up and down for birdie.
Yeah.
Which is not, I mean, it seems to me that the design of that hole is about getting people to hit it way left, as you say, and not slice one back onto 15 fairway.
Yeah. Well, and there were way too many bunkers in the corner. So if you got rid of most of the bunkers in the corner and you did what we did at the 6th at Peninsula on the north, south, north of Peninsula, and you created an avenue down the right with a 2-iron where you can play short right with a 2-iron or a 3-iron and then pitch into a front right flag, come in underneath the bunker to a front right, then that would be that. Then that would transform the hole. It's not complicated. The fix is not complicated at all. It's actually, it would be easy to make it into a really good hole. And then of course the other disaster they made was there was a captain who was had a fetish with spectator mounds. When Metro had a whole lot of tournaments in the 80s, they built the horrific piles of dirt around the outside of the dog leg as spectator mounds, which was just, and it's like they should have got rid of them.
Yeah.
Years ago. I mean, why are they still there? Just cut it away. You know, so it's that's miles away from being as, you know, that was it? Yeah, it's just miles away from being a really good hole. Yeah. No, it's not like it's a bad hole. It's just not particularly interesting.
No, agreed.
Yeah.
Changing tack a little bit, you in recent years have become a bit of a mentor of young golfers, you know, whether that's Suo that you mentioned earlier, Lucas Michel, Elvis Smiley now. What is it about that role, you know, that you seem to kind of now be the go-to kind of person for a young golfer who's trying to learn how to become a coherent touring player?
Yeah, or someone who needs a cheap caddy. accidental, really. I mean, Sue was at Metro, and she rang me one night and said, Golf Australia have organised a caddy for me for the Australian Open. It was the Open of Victoria that I think Carrie won it. Carrie Webb won. 2014, maybe. And what do you think I should do? And I said, why don't I caddy for you? So she said, can I call you back? So I assume she asked her dad. So she rang back and said, well, would you mind? I said, well, I wouldn't have offered it if I would have minded. So sure. So we did that and she played really well. And then we went to the Craft Nabisco, whatever that was called, the thing in the desert. And she made the cut and played well. Then we did the Olympics together and just, you know, we just did stuff and we played together at Metro and we like each other. So she's a friend as much as anything. And then Lucas just turned up from Lake Karanup. I met him at Karanup when we were working over there. And he was 14, I think, when we did that job. So he came to Melbourne and joined Metro because he had a choice of Kingston Heath or Royal Melbourne or Metro. And he joined Metro because that were the three reciprocals with Karanup. So he just, you know, we started playing and we caddied a bit and he was interested in design and, you know, he got into jumping on machines and building stuff. So he's now working for us, which is fun. And then Elvis was, I've known Liz and Pete, Elvis's parents, since we used to meet up with them at Wimbledon. I've got a picture of Elvis, of Debbie and I with Laura, who was Elvis's eldest sister when she was like three at Wimbledon. So, you know, she's maybe 10 years older than Elvis. So I've known that family forever, not forever, but for, you know, 30, 40 years. So, and then when Elvis watched Sue, I don't know if you can still find it. He was on the 18th green when Sue won the thing at Royal Pines. When he was a little kid, 14-year-old kid, he was out watching her play. And so he came down to Melbourne to play and we played a little bit. And so we just, you know, fumbled our way into a Cassard caddying for him a bit. And he plays well. He's going to be good, I think. Did you ever see Johnny Miller hit the ball? You probably never did.
No.
Miller hit these beautiful, high, soft irons that were just like, it was sort of this really distinctive flight. And Elvis hits the same shots. It's the same really soft, high, beautiful iron shots. He's really good at it. So, you know, I think he's going to be good. I think he's got a shot at being a really good player. Nice kid.
What is it about that role that you enjoy?
I don't know. I think it's good having emotional investments in young people who are interested in doing well at what they do. Kind of an important part of what old people should do, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think. So, and they're good kids. They're really, you know, they're fun. We're friends. We're, you know, it's not like, you know, we do stuff. We had dinner with Lucas last night and you know, we do stuff, and it's fun to see their lives evolve and change, and see Lucas go through the I want to be a golf pro thing, and you know that okay for him at the tour school where he, in Australia where he missed it by a shot, I think, and then which was a blessing in disguise because he stayed an amateur and won the mid-amateur and got to play in the Masters.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting going into meetings at golf clubs with Lucas and, oh, you played the Masters. You know, it's almost like, well, you know, you must know a lot about golf courses because you played the Masters. Well, actually, no, not necessarily true. But, you know, it's good to have someone. And he's the one of five Australians on the World Top 100 panel. He's probably the youngest guy on it. And he's seen an amazing amount of golf around the world. He's been to so many courses that, you know. So that's great for someone who wants to work in the design business because you've got to have seen a lot and thought a lot and read a lot and played a lot. And that stuff all helps make people good at designing golf courses and building golf courses. And of course, he worked with Mike DeVries at Seven Mile Beach for a while. So that, you know, that's like, you know, caddying for Tiger Woods for 3 months.
Yeah. I feel like Lucas, you know, I know after the Masters experience, you know, the winning the mid-am, playing the US Open in the Masters, I know there was an umming and ahhing between pursuing touring golf and pursuing architecture. And I feel like COVID almost then sort of forced that decision for him. But, you know, it seems like that maybe, you know, sliding doors moments of life, it seems like that happening and then the formation of CDP Golf and the opportunity at Seven Mile Beach and some of the other stuff you're doing, it seems like that's working out pretty well for him.
Yeah, you know, we've got a decent amount of work in Perth, Wembley and Royal Perth, I think. And so I think we can keep him in work, which is good. That's, you know, when you employ people, you want to keep them in work. It's kind of the idea. But the problem with pro golf is now is that there are, having been to the tour school with Elvis in Europe, there are way too many kids and others at the European Tour School. So you get both ends of the spectrum. Alvaro Quiros was there and, you know, a few guys who, you know, there were guys who won tournaments on the European Tour, won multiple times on the European Tour back at the Tour School. So you get them at both ends. But either way, there are way too many people trying to make a living out of pro golf for way too few jobs. There's not enough jobs for them all. You know, I've said 100 times, it's, you know, not the most important thing about the rollback debate, but the equipment debate is that you need to, you know, come out with equipment. Well, the best players in the world and the aspiring best players in the world need to play with equipment that much easier differentiates between great shots, average shots, bad shots, you know, every level of shot. You need clubs that differ and balls that make it easier for the most talented players, the best swingers and the best hitters, to break out of the pack. And it's never been harder to break out of the pack because it's never been easier to play golf with the ball, just the ball and the driver. Because they just do a horrible job of identifying Greg Norman as a driver of the golf ball, or Ian Woosnam, or Seve, who was a great driver, or Nicklaus, or Weisskopf, or the guys who are great drivers. Graham Marsh was a great, not as long as those guys, but still, he flushed it. You know, it's just so much harder to find those players because everyone does it.
Yeah. Yeah, and the high toe lands 5 yards to the behind and 10 yards to the right of the flushed drive on tour.
Yeah.
Given the same clubhead speed. And it's like, well,
what's the difference?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, Robert Rock was, John Huggan watched Robert Rock play a practice round somewhere, and I mean, good swinger, good player. And he hit a drive somewhere and he walked over to Huggy. He said, I've got no idea where I hit that ball on the face. I have no idea which part of the club it came out of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if with a wood, you knew exactly which part of the club it came out of. And it was a distinctly different fly. You could tell when someone had necked it or plated it or hit it in the toe or skied it a bit. All those shots look completely different. Watch Robin Choi play at the Sandoff tournament. And every drive she hit was identical, which was impressive in a way. You couldn't do that. Well, you could do that with a wooden driver. It was just really hard to do because inevitably you'd hit one out of the neck or out of the toe or out of the plate or a bit on the roof.
Yeah.
And they just look completely different. Or if you got steep on it into the wind with a ballada ball, you know, you can just tell by the flight of the ball that, well, that wasn't any good.
Yeah.
So going back to Lucas, that's the issue with all these young kids playing golf is how do you, you know, differentiate between them? How do you find out who's really good and who's not quite as good and who's just average but looks good because the equipment's easier to use? And if you can't hit a long iron, then get a hybrid. Or just get a long iron, or just get one of these hollow, massive hollow four irons that look like fly like two irons. And, you know, so the most impressive shots I ever saw were Seve and Greg and Woozy hitting long irons. You know, shots that we couldn't hit. Now, you knew that they were better because, well, I can't hit that shot. And, you know, true that, you know, there were things that other players could do that Greg couldn't do. But, you know, like Faldo could hit a two iron onto the 72nd hole in a major. But, which is not a fair shot. But, you know, that was, you know, people, you know, was Greg a better player? Greg was a better player week to week. But when it came to hitting the great shot into the 11th green at Augusta on the 74th hole, the play of the Masters, then he did it. You know, he just pulled out that great shot every single time. That iron into the last at Muirfield, and he didn't win at Madonna, but that three iron he hit to the 18th at Madonna in 1990, it was an incredible shot.
Yeah. And it goes back to what we're talking about Ogilvy before. Like, there's plenty of guys who could throw in a bag of balls on a Tuesday afternoon and hit that little pitch to a green above your head.
Yeah.
Over and over and over. But on the last hole of a major,
yeah,
that's when it's,
yeah, that's exactly right.
Now, you mentioned the Smiley family before and kind of a long association with them. You seem quite connected to the game of tennis as well. And has that been a lifelong interest of yours, or is it the outcome of getting to know some of them when you were a leading golfer and they were leading tennis players?
Both. The first time I heard an American accent was at Keong, and I walked past Billie Jean King and she said grass. Because we didn't have a TV at home. We didn't get a TV until I was like 12 years old, which is actually a good thing. But that was the first American accent I'd ever heard. And that was in 1963 or 4, because my mum was a tennis player. And I guess she wanted me to play tennis. And we'd go to the tennis to watch. I always liked watching tennis. I didn't ever play it, really. But I think it's an interesting sport. I like hearing people talk about it and discuss the technique. And, you know, I like watching people play tennis well. And then we met through Steve Fraser, who started a management company. We met the tennis players, Paul McNamee and John Fitzgerald and Peter McNamara and Mark Edmondson and Brad Drewett and Wally Masur, all those guys. We met them at the tournaments in Australia, and they'd come and play, we'd play golf together, and then we'd go to Wimbledon, and because we were in Europe and they would always organise tickets for Wimbledon, so we would go there, and that's where we met Liz and Pete. And so it's just, and then, you know, you get to play golf with Ivan Lendl. I mean, every time Lendl comes out to Australia, we play golf every day when he's coaching Andy Murray. I mean, how do you meet Ivan Lendl? I mean, it's like, you know, here was this guy who was a god when we were growing up. It was, you know, they were part of this Lendl, McEnroe, and Connors with the Gerolaitis. They were the meanest, you know, that was the generation. Mm-hmm. That was peak tennis for me. And you get to play golf and you just realize he's just a kind of human being who just, you know, has the same issues that every other human has. And, you know, they're interesting people and that's fun to meet. And that's why golf's such a great game. You get to play golf with Lloyd Cole and Ivan Lendl. You meet these people just because you play golf. And they're, you know, they're interesting people and they're fun people to, you know, not that, you know, and they're not interesting because they're famous. They're interesting because they're interesting people and they've done interesting things. And it's fun to talk about music, which I know nothing about, and talk about tennis and talk about, you know, things that aren't in our world.
Yeah. Speaking of tennis, and you mentioned Wally Masur, and for a second in my head, I decided that was Scott Draper. But Scott Draper and his golf career, is that one of the most under-celebrated achievements in Australian sport?
I saw him. He walked around watching Elvis play the last round of the PGA. Chook and I played with him in the Vic Open at Woodlands, and he hit the ball better than we did and missed the cut by 5 or 6 at least, and we made it easily. And he sort of shook his head when he walked off the 36th green, as did we. But I think that was the week he did. He win the mixed doubles at the Australian Open or something. He was playing golf and going to the tennis and playing. I think he was still playing both that week. It was a week. I think he won. He either did well on the doubles or mixed up, whatever.
So anyway. He and Sam, I've got his Wikipedia open and it mentions that. So Draper made his professional debut in the 05 Victorian Open, a 54-hole event played from the 28th to the 30th of Jan. He'd also accepted an offer from Sam Stosur to play in the mixed doubles at the Australian Open, which finished on the 30th, and he and Stosur reached the semifinal.
Okay, well, that was...
So he had to play the first round of the Vic Open golf in the morning and then went over and played the semifinal of a Grand Slam tennis in the Arvo.
Yeah, that was the week Chuck and I played it. But he won the New South Wales PGA, which is not a massive tournament in Australia. No one remembers it aside from the fact that Scott Draper won it. And it probably wasn't a great field, but it would have been decent.
Mm. And he shot 20 under to win it.
Yeah, so... There've been, Ellsworth Vines and Frank Connor and was Baby any good at tennis? She was, wasn't she? Zaharias? I mean, she was the greatest athlete
ever. She was good at everything, right?
Yeah, she was good at everything. But, Frank Connor and Ellsworth Vines were golfers and tennis players. And he was, to win a tournament on the Australian Tour, I thought, no matter how small or how average the field was, it was still decent. I thought that was miraculous that he won that tournament. Because he was a hell of a tennis player, like really good. Mm. He was a properly good tennis player. So, yeah, that's an underrated achievement, Scott Draper. He was a good player, really good player.
And so you said, that he hit it better than you or Chook, but you made the cut and he missed it by 5. I feel like maybe that describes a lot of the young guys we kind of referenced earlier who want to make it but then ultimately don't. What is it that stops, so in Scott Draper's case, what did you and Chook have that he didn't? To let you overcome the shortcoming of ball striking?
Well, we're just better at getting the ball in the hole. And we probably knew how to handle the pressure of playing that event, which wasn't, the Vic Open, when we were past it, a long way past it, but it wasn't exactly a high-pressure event. But you want to make the cut and you want to play well. But I'm sure we probably managed our nerves probably better than he did. And we'd grown up with it. So you learn when you start playing schoolboy golf how nerves impact how you play, and you learn how to deal with them. I'm sure he learned that in tennis. There's playing golf and there's tournament golf. I'm sure there's playing tennis and there's tournament tennis, championship tennis, and they're not particularly similar because the pressures are different and your swing feels different. But you learn when you're playing as a kid how to manage that, how competition golf feels different. And you know what's going to happen to your swing, and you know how it's going to feel. Okay, I know what's going to happen now. I've been here before. I can deal with that. But if you haven't grown up dealing with that from when you're 13 years old, then it's hard to learn it when you're 35 or 40.
Mm.
Because playing golf in the comp on Wednesday is not playing the Vic Open. It's just not the same thing. And playing golf in the Vic Open on Thursday is not the same thing as playing the last hole in the US Open at Wingfoot.
No.
That's completely unrelated. It's golf, but not as we know it. So there are things you learn, I think, as a kid growing up. You learn how to handle the pressure and handle the nerves, and you understand what's going to happen. And you kind of know when you're in a mess and when you're not. And you learn how to make cuts by missing them. And you learn how to win tournaments by missing cuts.
Yeah.
Having to par the last 4 holes to make the cut on Friday night's often more difficult than winning a tournament. Because, Lee Jarena said, what's pressure when you've got a 10-foot putt for 100,000? Well, if you miss it, you get 60 grand. That's pretty good.
Mm.
Interesting.
So they're the sorts of lessons, Mike, that you're really trying to pass on to that younger generation, like the Lucases and Elvises that you've mentored.
Yeah, a little bit. And Elvis, Elvis knows nothing about golf because he's never read a book on golf. And he made 7 down the first hole at the Vic Open last year on the third day. And we were walking to the second tee and I said, what Ben Hogan said about that, don't you, Elvis? Of course, he's got no idea. He said, now, what did Ben Hogan say? He said, that's why they make 18 holes. Because Hogan famously started off a round somewhere with a triple bogey. And he walked onto the next tee and said to whoever he's playing with, that's why they make 18 holes. You know, so I don't know if that helps or not, but there's always a line. You know, there's always something that happened to someone before that's, you know. But the classic thing was that we did the qualifying at the Royal Cinque Ports, your course, this year, and the rough was thick and wet. It's left-handed. So the first couple of times he got in it, well, the first time he got in it, he slashed out of it, and the ball went, for a right-hander, it's that shot that just goes, the grass wraps around the shaft, and the ball just goes sideways left. Of course, for him, it goes sideways right. And then he did it again. And then he did it again, like three times in. And he said, I can't believe it. He said, the club's just turning over when I hit it. I said, you know you've got to hang on as tight as you can with this shot. He said, what do you mean? I said, you've got to hang on to the grip as tight as you can so it doesn't do that. He didn't know that. And I'm thinking, well, how can you not know that? But when you play in Australia, why would you know that? Because where do you get that shot in Australia? Where do you get foot high, wispy, wet grass in Australia to play it? You don't play that shot anywhere. So why would you know that? Well, you not a good time to learn it at the qualifier for the British Open, but you know, you won't make that mistake again.
Well, you won't forget it.
No. So, you know, that's it's all part of learning how to play golf, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
And you know, and I try and, you know, be Steve Williams or Squirrel when I caddy. I know what they would say goes through my head, and that's why, you know, I mean, I obviously do a bit, you know, a lot of it's what I think myself, but you know, those guys were, you know, I had a bunch of great caddies when I played golf, and you know, they're always sort of in the back of my head saying, how would Steve deal with this? You know, and there were lots of times when he would have dealt with it better than I did, but you know, it's such a weird game because Elvis is, we had a bunch of shots at the Australian Open that were dead 160 meters, like dead on, not 159, 161, but we had five times in the week that was 160 dead on. It's an 8-iron. For me, that was a 5-iron. 175 yards was a 5-iron. For everyone, that was a 5-iron shot. So I'm thinking like, well, how the hell did he get an 8-iron that far? But most of the time he does. But he was playing well the second day. He was kind of on the edge of the top 10. We got to the 7th hole, which was our 16th. Perfect drive into the wind. I think it was a 160 number. 8-iron. I'm going like, this is a 7-iron shot. Like, you know, I'll aim it way to the left. But, you know, and he hit a kind of marginal shot, got in the wind, was the wrong club, short in the water, 6. You know,
yeah. Well, I'm sure I've told this story on this podcast before, but that was for me one of the absolute like clarity moments in learning golf was playing with you at the Lakes. I was on 10 and I had about 108 into some wind. And it was a back pin on 10 there. And you walked over after hitting your shot and you said, what are you gonna do here? I said, oh, I'm trying to decide if it's a you know, a hard wedge or a 9. And you said, bullshit, that's an 8-iron shot. I said, no, 8-iron will go too far. And you looked at me and you said, well, don't hit it as hard then.
Yeah.
That's an 8-iron shot. That's and right. It was this clarity that I'd never thought of that. It was always governed by distance.
Yeah.
But it is, once you've seen that light, it's like, yeah, there are some shots that are just saying, this is the club, then it's up to you to work out how to hit that club for the scenario.
And it's sort of the rangefinder generation. You know, the boof, click, 110 yards, that's a wedge. Well, throw the rangefinder away and have a look at it and go, well, I can just bump that in there with an 8-iron. We played with the guy at Yarra Yarra today, who he had, it was windy, and he had maybe 60 meters into the 18th hole. And he hit this beautiful shot that got spinning and landed about 5 feet from the hole and started sucking back. And I stopped watching. I was in the bunker and I look up and the ball's off the green. Came all the way off the green. I said, what'd you hit there? He said, 60. I said, you know, it's probably a 50. Hit a 50. And just pitch it through the wind with no spin. Mm. And he got it. He completely got it. I mean, he knew that. But he hit what looked like a good shot. And most people, well, that's a good shot. And it was within 4 or 5 feet of the hole, but the wind was strong enough. And he hit it well enough to spin the hell out of it. And back it came off the front of the green. You know, it was weird. But, you know, that was it was completely the wrong shot. But he was a cricketer who was like a, you know, good player with a bad technique.
Yeah.
Who, with a better technique, would have been a scratch player. But he was inside, you know, we were talking about it. He was inside and across, so he blocked it and hooked it with his driver. Now, he's the modern nightmare player. Strong, fast, big head, dodgy technique. His great shots are great, and his bad shots are, you can't solve the boundary problem.
Mm. Well, hopefully he's an Australian Golf Passport listener, and he can hear that absolute takedown of his capabilities.
Yeah. But he was a good teacher and 6 months work away from being a scratch player.
Yeah.
Because he could really hit it. And but he doesn't think that. You know, if you said to him, you can be a scratch player in 6 months, he'd laugh at you. But he could do that. Because the good shots he hit, he flashed. Like, he hit a beautiful long iron into the eighth hole. It's a fantastic shot. Like a shot. It was a proper shot. You know.
He just needs the Mike Clayton finishing school.
Yeah.
I have a recollection, and it's a long time ago now, but it kind of segues from what you've just been talking about you being quite insistent that the fundamentals get way overlooked by most golfers, and it's are to blame for probably 70% is my recollection of you saying the bad things people do in the golf swing, if they worried about their grip, their posture, their ball position, their alignment, a lot of that stuff would be eliminated. Is that an accurate recollection?
Yeah, if I ever had a piece of advice for a golf pro who, as a golf pro, you're going to play a million pro-ams, if you get one of those rubber grips, molded rubber grips in your bag, leave it in your bag, and every guy you play with, rather than trying to teach him how to grip the club, just give him that. Now, here's how you hold the club. I don't think I've ever helped anyone, but I've played with countless, hundreds of people probably with bad grips who just sentence themselves to a life of bad golf because they won't learn how to hold the club properly. And not every bad player, most bad golfers, because people have bad grips. And you can't play with a bad, you can't play golf with a bad grip. You know, as Harvey Penick said, if you don't want to learn how to grip the club properly, you don't want to play good golf.
And is there a typical bad grip you see? Is it the right hand too far underneath the club?
Right hand way under, shut face. You know, just they're going to duck hook it, so they block the hell out of it. And you can never play a bunker shot because you take the loft off the club, and the only way to put the loft back on the club is break your wrist. And you can't play a bunker shot with a broken left wrist because you're either going to guts it or fat it. So you just can't play with a bad grip. Yeah, you know, that should be the biggest selling item in every golf club pro shop. So one of those black molded grips, and just learn how. And you can learn how to do. You can learn how to hold the club watching TV. Just sit there and hold the grip for 3 hours a night. You'll figure it out. I mean, you know, I did a tweet when we were locked down in COVID. It was along the lines of, "There's no excuse for any golfer to come out of this lockdown with a bad grip."
Yeah.
Because you don't have to play golf. You can just go and hold the club and learn how to hold it properly. And in 6 months, it'll feel instinctive. When you're back playing golf again, you'll be a 10-shot better player. Of course, that never happened because, you know, still. But it's true. The grips are, you know.
Well, the idea of practice always is way more appealing to choppers like me than the reality. I bought a putting mat during COVID, and, like, I might have putted on it 3 times.
Yeah.
It's just, you think you're going to be, it's like New Year's resolutions. You convince yourself you're going to be a different person, a much better person next year, and the reality is you're not. And most of us don't practice enough, and that's why we're not very good at the game.
And you can putt on a carpet. You know, you can just putt without a ball. Just practice your stroke.
Just another quick mention here for Angus and Grace Go Golfing. Just want to take a moment to call out Angus and Grace Go Golfing's super breathable and lightweight eyelet polos. These are back for summer. They were a fantastic hit during the warmer months of the 2022 to 23 summer. They're here in a new range of colours for men and women. The cut is a little bigger and looser than it was last season, which is probably a bit suited to warmer days on the golf course. They have a relaxed fit, and the material is really worth focusing on for a second. Good Earth cotton being grown in Australia for the world's first climate-positive, traceable cotton program. The fabric's woven in Australia, the garment's made in Australia. This is Australian-made as it gets. Beautiful, high-quality fabric in a wonderful cut, in a beautiful range of colours, available in men's and women's range. Charcoal, navy, mandarin, natural, sky blue, chocolate. They're a fantastic option for summer days on the golf course or even just casual wear when you're away from the golf course. Angus and Grace Go Golfing, 39 William Street, Paddington, or angusandgracegogolfing.com. Get in there and have a look at their eyelet polos for summer and all of their fantastic range, including the No Laying Up, Sugarloaf Social Club, and other offerings.
Yeah, we've covered quite a few of the hats you've worn in the game. And obviously this question relies on, you know, you're going back in time, but you're taking all the knowledge that you have, that you've picked up about golf over the years. If you go back to being 20 years old and only play, design, or write about golf, which would you choose and why?
I could only play or only
play professionally.
I could only do one of the three.
So you can only play professionally, design courses, or write about golf.
I would probably design courses, I think. If I was 20, I would have gone and done what Mike DeVries did and learned how to drive machines and build stuff. I think that would be really fun. I mean, he loves it. He down at Cape Wickham every day building stuff. He said, I got into golf course design to feed my bulldozer habit. He loves it, you know, and that's a hugely important part of design is understanding how to move dirt and build stuff. And, you know, I can wave my arms around and put the tee there, but the guys who build stuff are critically important to good job, which is why the best guys now do the best work, because they've got the best builders working for them. And then they're also guys like, you know, Brian Schneider, they're great at design. They're good designers in their own right. So, you know, that's why the profession has elevated itself so much since, you know, Corn Crenshaw, because the model changed. You know, the famous golf pro turning up to break the course record and sign the contract and not much else, and you know, contractors building work and just spewing out stuff that was okay but no better than okay. And Corin Crenshaw changed that model, and they became the superstars of golf course design, as Mackenzie and Ross and Tillinghast and Thomas and, you know, Simpson and Colt were the superstars of golf course design in the golden age. The profession completely changed.
Yeah.
To the era of the famous golf pro, and now it's swung back to, we're now in the era of the famous architect, and there are still famous golf pros getting lots of work, but all the great stuff, not all the great stuff, but most of the great stuff is done by the guys who weren't golf pros.
Yeah. Well, and it seems like, you know, if you use the band analogy, you know, Renaissance or Hans Design, CDP, you know, with all of you on site down at 7 Mile, it's like Led Zeppelin, where each of those four people were probably one of the best three at their instrument that they were. When you put them all together and they're combining and inspiring each other, that probably brings out, you know, the type of result.
Yeah, yeah. It's a fun environment. When you know, we're down at 7 Mile Beach, I go down there every second week for a few days. And I mean, Matt Goggin he's seen a routing map. There are no plans. Well, there's an irrigation design, so clearly you need that to figure out where the pipe's going to go on the ground. But Matt's never seen more than a one-page, you know, he hasn't seen one green drawing, one anything, because, you know, as Pete Dye said, why do I need plans? I'm always there.
Yeah.
So the process of going down there with Mike and, you know, going through, as the holes were coming out of the ground, you know, we'd go to the next hole. What sort of green are we going to build here? Where are we going to put the bunkers, and where are the tees going to go? And, you know, of course, I'm trying to find I'm driving Mike mad by finding tees all over the place. But I think it adds to the variety of the holes. I mean, it's not just so much golf in Australia. Almost every course in Australia, pretty much you play the tees one in front of the other. You know, there's no lateral movement of the tees. One, because we don't have that much space, but laterally moving tees is going to be a really fun part of playing 7 Mile Beach, is you can go to tees that are a long way apart and play different shots and different versions of the hole, and that's been fun. But it's, you know, that stuff only comes about when you're on the ground looking at it and discussing it and messing around and getting to know the property, because you're there so often. You hear the stories of, you know, I heard a story the other day of the celebrity designer turning up for the first time on the opening day. I mean, what's the fun in that? Now, that's like having a kid and turning up at its 21st birthday wondering how it turned out. You know, what's the point of that?
Yeah, it's a good analogy. It feels to me like the establishment of CDP Golf and the opportunity to build 7 Mile feels like it's really re-energized you professionally as a designer.
Yeah, well, when what happened to the last business happened, it was, you know, within 2 weeks, Mike and Frank and said, well, why don't we do this? So it was, for me, it was a choice of what do I do? Well, I mean, that wasn't a choice to get into business with those guys. That was, yeah, I'm in that. So I don't know how it would have turned out if that hadn't happened. I'd have stayed in design some way because I loved it and it's great fun. And, you know, and we're obviously working with Harley a lot now in Australia, Harley Cruz, which has been great. So we're, and the phone's ringing. So it's fun, you know, and we're working on some interesting courses and we've got a few in the pipeline, and you know, it's been great, really. It's been a lot of fun because it's what I love to do. So it's a cool job. The problem with that question, the writing or the playing, I mean, writing would be third, obviously, but writing opened the door to design for me. I wrote a column about Sanctuary Cove. It was the second column for The Age that I ever wrote, and I never would dare write it now. But John Sloan read that column, who I didn't know John at the time. He was the superintendent at Woodlands. And he'd taken the job at Sanctuary Cove as the superintendent. And so I read that column and rang him up and said, sorry, I'm not coming, because I knew you were right. And 5 years later, we started the business together. And John was like, I mean, John's back in golf courses, I know. He got out of it completely for, you know, almost 15 years, really. So certainly a dozen years.
Mm.
And he's now back in golf, which is great, because John was brilliant at what he did. He was great at running the business. He was brilliant at dealing with people. He was one of the best guys in the country on turf. He was just fantastic, and he was a great mentor to me. And I'm so happy he's back, and you know, we're back working together, which is brilliant. So it's and of course Bruce, you know, sadly died maybe 5 years ago now. But Bruce was a really talented guy. Bruce was a great shaper and he was a great turf guy. And you know, between Graham and Bruce and John, they transformed, and a few others, but they sort of led the year-round Cooch revolution in Melbourne, which transformed the condition of the golf courses. And, you know, they were, you know, when people write the history of Australian golf, they don't write about guys like that because they don't know the contribution they made, but they made, you know, huge contributions to the game here. I mean, Bruce put Fescue into Cooch at the Mooner Course of the National. That's why it's the best condition course on the mainland. Yeah, and I know John's amazed that, you know, as someone who was responsible for putting Cooch in lots of courses, he always thought there was another step on from that, which was, how do we make these courses better in the winter? And how do we make the shots around the green easier to play, because you're not chipping out a grainy Cooch? And the, you know, the national course at Moon is that the answer to that, I think, is, and the beach course at 13th Beach.
Yeah.
Put the Cooch in with the Fescue and see how you go.
Mike, you were talking about Mike DeVries before being on his dozer all the time. Did you ever seriously consider spending more and more time on the earth-moving side of things?
No, because I think I was too old to learn how to be any good at it at all. And I, if I'd been no good at it, I would have been really bad at it. I just would have made a mess of it and just been no good. So it never particularly struck me as something that I'd be very good at. But I think if you learn something when you're 20, you can learn anything if you've got a modicum of talent and you have good people teaching you. And Mike would be, you know, Mike's a great teacher, partly through watch how I do this. Mm-hmm. And then he'll sit with Lucas and, well, you know, do that. You did that wrong. And, you know, do that and work the blade that way. And so they're good, those guys. But it was I think if I'd had that sort of brain, then I'd have instinctively been drawn to wanting to jump into the machine and do it. And I never did because I just don't think I'd be very good at it.
And I think the world needs, the golf design world also needs the guy who can conceive of the strategy and using land. Like that's also, you know, you could build a beautiful course on the wrong corridors and it wouldn't be its best. So it needs all types, doesn't it?
Yeah. Which is the Ewing Meadows is just way too hard. Have you played there? Have you played there, Matty? It's like way too hard for the average player, like way too hard. You know, I think we're going to fill in, I don't know exactly how many, but a lot. Not 100, but probably less than 50. But is it just, why are these bunkers here? What's the point of this bunker? And which part of the 16th at Commonwealth did you miss here? Why is the water and a bunker on the same side of the fairway as the water? Why are we doubly penalising? Surely the water's enough to create the strategy. You don't need a bunker as well.
Yeah.
So it's that's why I think we're so lucky to grow up in Melbourne and play at Royal Melbourne, because that's the masterclass in here's how you do it. And there's lots of great golf in the Sand Belt, but Royal Melbourne's the masterclass. Now, the 17th hole on the West Course that's a pretty simple concept. The closer you go to the bunker, the easier that your shot is, because it's going to be shorter, because you're going to have driven it into the, you know, that's the shortest way to the hole, and it's the best line to the flag. And you can take the longer way around, which is why that's the difference between the first analogy I always use was Coolum, and Ewing Meadows is the same. It's the worse you are as a player, the harder the golf course gets. Royal Melbourne, the worse you are as a player, the easier the course gets to shoot, to play bogey golf.
Yeah.
And the harder it gets to play, to shoot 67. Coolum's, when I was playing well, Coolum was, I played well there a bunch of times. I finished up winning there, but I thought it was such an easy golf course. Then when I started playing badly, how do I ever get around this place? So I duck hooking in the water, and I imagine what a nightmare. It was a pro-am mostly when we played there. Well, nightmare, the 20 handicaps we're having on that place. And Ewing Meadows is the same, which is just a failure, for want of a better word, to understand Royal Melbourne, which is just give them, as Bobby Jones said, just give them plenty of room to hang themselves. You know, just give them a way around. But don't, you know, why are you punishing the bad shots of the poorest players? What's the point in that? So that's if we get to do what we want, I think we can make that place really good. Ewing Meadows, it's because there was lots of stuff that was done well there, but it's like, which part of Royal Melbourne did you miss here?
Yeah,
it can definitely be better than what it is at the moment.
Yeah. I never played there, but all I'd heard was, well, it's way too hard. And you start walking around it and around it and around it and around it. And it's like, well, this place is really hard. There's long par fives with water 40 yards across the short of the green, across the fairway. You know, who's going to go in that? Except someone who's probably not breaking 100 anyway. So I said to someone the other day, I said, if we've done our job, the biggest criticism will be you've made the course too easy. That's when I know we've done a really good job on that course.
Yeah.
Which was the knock on Yarra Yarra. You know, you can drive it anywhere, and they've made the course too easy. Well, that's why it's gone from 50 to 16 in the rankings, because they ruined the golf course. You know, well.
Same knock on Gunnamatta.
I was the first member, first non-member to play that golf course. The captain's, a friend of mine, got me down there to play. And he said, should we get the magazines to rank it? This was early on. Because all we've heard is it's too short and too easy and you can drive it anywhere. Because the members had only played off the whatever colour tees there were. We played 18 holes off the back tees. So, John, this is one of the hardest courses in Australia, tee to green, like off the back tee, because the members don't play off the back tees very much. I mean, there's that back tee, on the ninth hole where you drive blind over the sand dune. But that's a hard golf course. But there's plenty of room. You're not going to look for golf balls. There's plenty of room, and you've got to drive the ball well through the wind. which is an underrated test of driving. Good driving is not about just hitting the ball straight. It's about flying the ball through the wind and hitting to a specific part of the fairway, even though the stats guys will tell you that's bullshit and no one can drive that straight and that accurately. You know, partly they can't do that because the ball goes too far. But hitting the ball to one half of the fairway that gives you an easier shot than the shot you've got from the other half of the fairway, which was the whole basis of Royal Queensland, isn't that rewarding someone who drives the ball well?
But that's my whole issue, Clates, with that whole decade golf stats approach to the game, right? Because the angle may not benefit you on average over time.
Yeah.
And being able to hit it to the particular point may not be reliable on average over time.
Yeah.
But winning a golf tournament or shooting a personal best round in a comp, whatever, isn't about data over a lengthy period of time. It's about that moment and that shot that you have to hit. And ultimately, the guy who's winning or the girl who's winning a professional golf tournament on that day and that week is able to hit the shot exactly where they want to.
Yeah.
That's why they're going to win the golf tournament.
Yeah.
So I think part of it is like, yeah, that might be over time a good way to finish 15th a lot. But I do honestly think that someone who's trying to win whatever it is that they're at playing, if they're a good enough player, on their day they can hit it to the point that gives them the half shot advantage 10 times in the round.
Yeah.
I just think that stuff gets overly simplified that on average becomes all the time when that's not the case.
Yeah. And angles matter more when you're at a place like Royal Melbourne, when the greens are hard and bouncy and the wind's from a different spot. And you know, if you play the first on the east course and the pin's over the front right bunker, you don't want to be down the right. Don't tell me that angle doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. I mean, and maybe if you hit it left, and you're pitching up the green and the green's hard and it's windy and you're playing from the right, maybe you just hit from either place, you're 20 foot and you make four. But give someone 10 balls from the left and 10 balls from the right, the guy with 10 balls is going to score better.
Yeah.
And the angle and the shot is easier. And, you know, Doug said it best, I think, when he said, I just want to build a hole where the shot from one side of the fairway is completely different from the shot from the other side of the fairway, which is going back to not scoring at golf. That's the fun part about golf is the fifth at Royal Queensland does that really well. I think that's the best on the course. The members probably would never say that. But, you know, if you hit it down the left under the bunker, you've got a good angle, but it's blind. If you hit it up onto that little shelf in the middle of the fairway, you've got a good angle and you can see it. And if you hit it 30 yards right of that, you can see it, but it's a bad angle. And it's a harder. And maybe you're going to make four from every place. But it's a much different shot. There are three completely different shots. And if you're playing a golf course week after week after week, year after year after year, and it's the only course you play, then it's fun not to have to hit the same shot all day.
Yeah.
You know, if you drive it left, okay, now I've got the blind shot. If you hit the drum, okay, now I've got that shot. But if I go, now I've got that shot. So you've got three entirely different shots. Because if you have a 30-yard wide fairway and you just hit the ball straight down the fairway, then once you've played that hole, once you've played it 1,000 times, and it never changes. So that's why St Andrews is the best course in the world, because every time you play that golf course, it's just different. No matter where the pin is, where the wind is, where you drive the ball, it's just different every time you play it. You know, it's never been the same.
How many times do you reckon you've played the old course?
I've only ever played it in an open. I've never played it away from an open.
So truly?
I went 84 practice rounds, missed cut. 90 practice rounds, made cut. 95 playing horrible, practice rounds, missed cut. And they're the only rounds I've ever played there.
Wow.
Which is kind of, but I've walked it lots of times. Lots of times. I love Chuck and Simon Owen and I played the senior thing at Scottish Open at Fairmont, just up the road years ago. Mm-hmm. And we stayed in the house one night and we had dinner. And it was, you know, middle of summer and it's light till 11 o'clock. And we said, Sid, take us out and show us what happened when you and Jack Nicklaus played the 16th hole at the old course. So we drove down and we walked around and Sid, you know, he showed us where he chipped in from at the 15th and he showed us where Nicklaus hit it on 16 and where he hit it. And he just ran us through the whole thing. It was so cool.
So you know, I feel like that's an incredible flex of you being able to say, I've only played the old course in three British Opens.
Yeah, it is. Which is kind of just because Yeah, just because it's kind of, I mean, I would love to play it for fun, but you, how do you play the old course for fun when you're in the ballot and it's busy and it's slow and it's, I'd rather walk it than play it. I'd rather go out there at, you know, 8 o'clock at night in the middle of summer and just walk it with a friend. And I mean, Huggy and I did that. We started off walking the new course one Sunday, and I should have stayed with the new course because I've never seen it. And we got to the fourth on the old, and said, let's go and walk the old course. So we just walked the old course again. It's the best walk in golf, walking the old course, but one of them.
Now you've seen a lot of the planet with golf clubs in tow. What's the last holiday you took without the intention of playing or building golf?
The last holiday, I was looking at my wife. The last holiday we took without the intention of playing or building golf, have we ever?
Once we went to.
Oh, we did. Oh, here's another flex. Sorry, apologies for the flex. She said we did it once. We went to stay with Peter McNamara and Isabel, his partner, in Ascona. Isabel was from Switzerland. And we went and stayed in her childhood home in Ascona, which is just over the Italian border. We spent a week there. Now, we did play golf. We played at Ascona. Peter and I
played golf.
No, she's saying I didn't take my golf clubs. So I play with rental clubs. I hate playing with rental clubs.
Oh, I don't think you do.
Yeah, but you know, very rarely, which is bad because I should do that. But no, well, because our holidays are at home.
Mm.
You know, we don't. Why would you go on a holiday when you spend?
Well, when you pack home a bag all the time to work, absolutely.
You don't want
to.
Yeah.
Where in the world have you never been but you'd love to go?
Probably South of Argentina. Probably I want to go and see the Jockey Club. But I've never been. I've been to South America. I've been to Rio, but. I'd like to go to, I don't know why, Argentina probably, but and other parts of Scandinavia apart from Sweden. So I always thought that was an interesting, I always loved it up there. So I thought they were kind of Northern Hemisphere Australians, Swedes.
Yeah.
Kind of sensible and liberal and smart and fun, but they drink more than us.
We opened our chat talking about why Australia's, you know, so fantastic and a great place to live. Outside of Australia, though, your favourite country?
Interesting. Somewhere in Europe, probably. I would have always said France. Probably, I love the parts of France are amazing. But I love England. I really enjoy England, Scotland, England, Britain. I love it over there. Because I never feel at home in America. I always feel like a foreigner in America. And I, no matter how many times I go there, but I go to Europe and always feel at home. I just feel, because I understand it, because I lived there for so long and we traveled so much. So you know, you go to Barcelona with Elvis for the tour school and just, you know, I get this place. I understand it. But I really enjoy England because the golf's great and the architecture's great and I understand the people, I think, and we've got friends there and, you know, it's just I like it. I like England.
So what's next then? Like 7 Mile is the big kind of focus at the moment.
Yeah.
Helping Elvis with his career. What do you think will be keeping you busy, you know, 18 months from now when 7 Mile's built?
Yeah, just design work. You know, we've got a few shots at work in America. We've got, we're going to clean the Addington up, which has been great. You've played the Addington, right?
I've played the Addington 25 times. It's probably the course I played the most when I lived in London. Yeah. It was nearby me.
So you haven't played it without the trees?
No. I'm going to be in London next August, July, August. So I'm keen to go and look at it and see what it's like cleaned up.
Hopefully I'm over there. We should go and see that because that's – that was owned by – for people who don't know the Addington, owned by an old lady who – his idea of preserving it was doing nothing, which did the exact opposite of preserving it. It just got madly overgrown and the new owner, Ryan, who – loves it. It's just, he's pulled out way more trees than we ever would have. But it's just opening it back up to what it was when Abercrombie did it. It's just been amazing, the transformation of that golf course.
And it was, it was majestic when it was choked in trees.
Yeah.
And so I can't believe that it's going to be better than that now, even though the pictures make it pretty clear it's going to be better than that now. So I'm pretty pumped about that.
Yeah, no, it's great. So more design work. I mean, we're Wembley's a really cool job in Perth. It's a, there's 180,000 rounds a year, 26 million balls on the driving range. And I think the council are up for something kind of radical.
As that's in, really cool.
You know, rebuild the old course. And then the new course is not good. But it's on, it's like a lot of Perth golf. It's bad golf on great land. So I think our concept is going to be short 12-hole course, 12-hole par 3 course, 12-hole pitch and putt course, Himalayas putting green, and redo the old course. So, I mean, it's the busiest course in Australia by, it's Moore Park's probably second, but it's a pity Moore Park, the people who are in control of Moore Park don't have the same attitude as the people in Wembley. But, you know, it's a, it's literally a cradle to grave place for golfers. You get little kids on a, and I detest mini golf, like I detest golf carts. But I guess, you know, people love it, but I don't get it. But you get a three-year-old kid on a Himalayas putting green and give him a little putter and say, just have at it. And then they go to the little, you know, 40, 50-hole pitch and putt course. Then go to the par 3 course. Then go to the short hole 12 course. Then go to the big course. And then reverse the journey.
Yeah.
When you get old. And it's like, how cool would that be to do that? So that's a really fun job. You know, it's not as, it's probably not as fun as 7 Mile Beach because that's, you know, you get a shot at building one of the best courses in the world, and that's always going to be fun. But making something like Wembley into something that should be the poster child for what golf should be for everybody, and, you know, and different parts of the game for different players in the game and different levels of the game and different stages in your golfing life. And the older I get, the more I've, only in the last 6 months have I started to see how socially it's such an important game. You see so many old people just playing golf and you realize that that's probably what they do.
Yep.
You know, that's how they get out of the house and that's how they hang out together and spend time together. And it's because my golf's always been competitive and it's been work. And it's, you know, you, it's, maybe I'm just really slow, but you understand what an important game it is socially for people just to, you know, it's like people, couples going to dinner at night. It's the same thing. It's just four old guys or old women hanging out, doing something together.
Mm-hmm.
And then going to the clubhouse and having lunch.
Yeah.
And that's why it's such an important game. And that's why, you know, these Clover Moore who wants to take golf away from Moore Park without having any understanding of how important these places are for people.
Yeah.
Because if they're not doing that, what are they doing?
Well, and walking's this magic ingredient to a long life, right? And where else can you get 10,000 steps with a bit of purpose?
Yeah, and moving your body, turning it, and swinging your arms, and doing stuff, and trying to coordinate your hand-eye coordination, and keep, you know, that's you know, it's a miracle we can hit the ball on the face of a golf club at all, let alone the middle of it.
Yeah,
it shows how clever humans are. You know, if you said swing that thing at 120 miles an hour and hit the middle of that ball with the middle of that face, it's like, how do I do that?
Mm.
When the club's moving, I don't know how many feet the club moves, 20 feet between the takeaway and the back top of the backswing, going back to the ball. I mean, it's, how do we figure out how to do that? It's hard. It's why it's good, right? It's why it's fun.
Yeah.
No, that's why golf's good. Golf's good because it is hard. And it's that's what drives me mad about the rollback debate is golf's never been easier to play. How easy is golf now compared to what it used to be?
Yeah.
Hickory clubs and lousy balls and bad lies and bumpy greens and, you know, that was
no one fell in love with it because it's easy.
Yeah, it's exactly right. No one fell in love with it because it's easy.
You're talking about your games with Ivan Lendl and Lloyd Cole before as well. It's an important game for social reasons and for the exercise reasons, but it's an unbelievable bridge. And we would all have experiences where we've been walking down a fairway and chatting with someone in our foursome where, were it not for golf, we might not ever have met those people or had those shared experiences.
Yeah, you never would have met them. How do you ever meet people like that, you know? And, it's, of course, they're way less important than the people you've never heard of who you meet, who are just regular people who you just play golf with. They were, you know, they're... You know, not all my friends are from golf, but most of them are. And it's, you know, that's why it's such a cool game and why it's such an important game. And it's, you know, it's all part of society and why, you know, it's why tennis is important and You know, all the, why so many things are important. You know, the things we do together are important. You know, so it's a great game. It's a cool game, and it's the most interesting game because of where you play it. And yeah. The element of, you know, the stupid argument about what, you know, the rollback again, the rollback thing. You know, do we want to make the 100-meter track 110 meters just to make it harder? Well, it's a stupid argument. I mean, the only point of a 100-meter track is to see how far someone can run from one end to the other.
Yeah.
You know, that's not what golf is. Way more nuanced and complicated than that.
No, a lot of those what abouts and what ifs with the rollback, they just don't land because, you know, golf is different and special and that's what we love about it. But
yeah,
some people are determined not to understand that. And yeah. And I find it's best for my mental health not to engage with them.
Yeah. And it's just someone, I think it was it Andy Johnson, someone who made the point that, and I've written an article about it for Golf Australia tomorrow, but if you lived in Denver and you got invited to Cypress Point, would you not go because the ball goes 20 yards shorter?
Yeah.
But that's the lunacy of this argument. Yep. Is, no, I'm not going to go and play Cypress Point because the ball don't go as far.
Or do you not play golf in winter because the ball in goes winter. Shorter?
Yeah. You know, I grew up playing at Eastern where the ball would plug in the winter and run 80 yards in the summer. Well, everyone still played golf in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
It's just these arguments are so nonsensical. And it's the same campaign as every other lobby group. You know, the cigarette, you know, banning cigarettes in restaurants. You're going to close restaurants down. Well, last I looked, there were still plenty of restaurants going. Yeah. How much better is going to a restaurant with people not smoking in it? And people used to smoke in aeroplanes? What's that about?
Yeah.
You know, it's just the tactic of every lobby group is fear. And it's just, no, we're not going to fall for this crap. You know, it's just make the ball go a bit shorter. And, of course, the Sandbelt Tournament, going back to the Sandbelt Tournament, every group I watched on the 17th at Yarra Yarra, 366 metres downhill, every group waited on the tee, the mm-hmm. green to clear. And Matt Griffin hit it on the green. 40-year-old broken down tour pro hit it on the green, who should have won the tournament, who played great. But, you know, this is ridiculous.
And, it, and if you were us riding him home, there were a couple of us getting hole by hole updates on the back nine of East on that Thursday, yeah. thinking he was going to clinch that for a while.
Yeah. And then I got the text on my phone from Tony Rule, captain of Royal Melbourne. Gale, hole in one at 16. Wow. Anyway, there it is.
Well, mate, you've been incredibly, incredibly generous as always with your time. And I feel like you only have to ask a half interesting question and you get 15 minutes of the most interesting shit you've ever heard in your life out of Mike Clayton. It's
anyway,
great.
Maybe. All right. Anyway, hopefully it's not too boring. Anyway, it is what it is.
I think people keep asking you on their podcast because it's never too boring.
All right. Maybe not. Anyway, when are we catching up? We need to play golf again. So let's organise that when we next time we're in Sydney or you're in Melbourne. And
indeed. We'd love to have you. We'd love to all have right. you. And hopefully we can align diaries for London. That'd be sensational.
Yeah, no, we should do that. That'd be great. So I'll be over there at some point in the summer. So I'll work on August.
Very good. Matty, as always, good fun. You guys listening at home haven't heard a lot of Matt Mollica tonight because he's having a few tech difficulties, but he's with us. And this will be the last one for the year from us. So thank you to everyone for listening. Thank you, Clates, for spending some time with us to cap out the year. Hopefully a good fun listen for some people maybe while they're driving home for Christmas.
Yeah, and the podcast, I've listened to everyone. They've been great. So it's good that...
Thank you, mate.
It's good that people are talking about this stuff because it's... Someone should talk about it. And it's fine to have Americans talk about it, but it's good to have Australians talk about Australian golf.
Doesn't matter. We're having so much fun doing it that we're really pleased that people are also listening to it.
No, it's been great. So we want more of this next year.